From Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in our Southwest studios in La Crosse. And today on the program, in a moment, we're going to be talking with the La Crosse Police Department and talking about enforcement now that things are starting to open back up in our community. Later in the show, we'll hear from some people about how resources for the homeless are holding up in light of COVID-19. And as the pandemic continues, even though society is starting to reopen. And then a conversation with the Midwest Music Fest about an effort to provide some funding for artists, musicians, and others who have fallen on hard times since a lot of their work has kind of gone away. That's all coming up on Newsmakers today. Right now, we're talking to Captain Andrew Dittman from the La Crosse Police Department. Captain Dittman, thank you very much for joining us today.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for having me on.
For sure. So today, it's been a little about a week since things have started to reopen, and notably, Third Street wasted no time, and a lot of those establishments are open. But stores and parks and different things are opening all across our community. So why don't we start by getting you to talk a little bit about what that feels like after everything's kind of been in lockdown for a couple months, to have some of those businesses and other locations reopening.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously been a dramatic change, you know, since the Supreme Court decision last week, and we have to adapt quickly, just as we did it when we went into, the safer at home order. And, you know, we're staffing the same as we were during the order, responding to calls the same way. And, you know, our internal changes haven't changed much. It's just mostly some external stuff that we're seeing in the community. Obviously, our night shift officers are beginning to respond more to calls for service at taverns that are open, dealing some with, you know, people who have consumed too much, drunk drivers and stuff like that. There's not been a huge increase of calls for service like that, but there's been some.
So as you kind of alluded to some of the changes that were in place during the safer at home order, you might not have like exact statistics or numbers in front of you in terms of what kind of calls you were getting, but just as you kind of anecdotally reflect on what kind of calls were coming in during the safer at home order, how did that change as opposed to the kind of calls you normally receive?
There wasn't a real dramatic change in most call types for service. The one area where we did see an increase, we had like a 20% increase in domestic violence calls, and we kind of used the benchmark of that March 17th, the day that we received the safer at home order, up until I think the data that I last saw was May 15th. So during that time, and we track data through our crime analysts frequently, but we saw that increase in domestic violence. And like you said, I can only conjecture, you know, anecdotally, it might be due to people are just being together more in a home environment or wherever they live, people working from home, and just the added stress that came with, you know, economic changes or being required to make changes to your life, I think sometimes added stress, and expect that's probably what led to the increase that we saw. As far as any other calls for service, we did receive some calls reference the safer at home order itself, not a ton. We didn't take any enforcement action aside from just having discussions and asking for voluntary compliance when we received calls or officers observed someone gathering or acting in a way contrary to the order. So we really had good community partnership and, you know, community compliance with the order, or we did during the time that it was in place.
What about now that the order has been lifted? The Supreme Court's order basically means that unless the county institutes something, which they have not done, there isn't any order in place that carries any sort of penalty or anything. You know, there's in other words, there's advice out there about how people should act, but it's not enforceable advice. It's just advice. Do you have people now who are confused as to what they can or can't do?
I think so. I think for the most part, people understand what the Supreme Court action meant. But we do, I mean, people turn to the police a lot when they have questions about what's going on in the community. And so we try to do our best as far as the messaging that we're putting out. We're partnering with our local health department, other partners in the community, nonprofits, people in the criminal justice system, to continue to push a consistent message, especially through our city emergency operations center. So we look to the recommendations from the La Crosse County Health Department, and then we refer to those if people have questions about what they should be doing.
The safety of law enforcement officers is a topic of discussion often in our country, but usually not related to a prevalent illness of some kind. What measures have you had to take to make sure that your officers remain safe while they're out protecting the community?
Yeah, I mean, this is a great question. It's been a unique circumstance for us, something that we really hadn't trained for or expected. You know, we had the information coming up to the time before the Safer at Home order, where we were beginning to put practices into place with, you know, personal protective equipment, social distancing, the way we were staffing our shifts within the agency. And then as the order went into place, we began to realize, you know, maybe we needed to make some tweaks to that. So we secured, and we've always done well. We've really been fortunate to have the protective equipment that we need throughout all of this. We've had some great community partners that have helped, you know, sustain what we need for masks, protective eyewear, gowns, and stuff like that. So we've really been fortunate. I know around the country, others have been in not such a good place, but we're lucky in this area of the country. I could talk a little bit about some internal changes that we made, if that would be helpful to you.
Yeah,
too.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. So early in April, we went to an emergency schedule, which allowed for more time off for staff away from work. But then when they were on their work cycle, they were here for a longer period of time. And we pulled staff from every area of the department. So you've got right now, and we're still in that schedule. We're set to phase out at the beginning of June. But, you know, the Detective Bureau, they all put on uniforms and they're back in the squad cars. People from our Community Services Bureau are back working the streets. Our school officers, obviously school's not in session, same thing. So that's been a unique change for them. You know, changes to their personal life, having to get their child care straightened out and stuff like that. But the goal was to protect our staff and to, you know, limit their amount of exposure to their time here at work and then give them a longer break to try to keep them and their families healthy and the people that we serve healthy as well. That was one of the changes that we instituted. We've had some differential response to calls for service as well. We've asked people, if at all possible, we've been tried to take complaints over the telephone. So if it's not an emergency or someone's not specifically requesting to talk to an officer in person, try to do it over the phone or submit some digital data as far as evidence and stuff like that. And if we do go to someone's house, we're engaging in social distancing practices. If it's not an emergency situation, we typically ask the person to come outside, maintain a good distance, and try to communicate that way. So those are some of the changes that we've implemented.
I'm thinking of just the heightened emotion that a lot of people experience about this, and especially now that the order has been lifted. Some people approve of the Supreme Court's order. Some people do not approve of the Supreme Court's order. Some people have very strong feelings as to whether members of the public should still be wearing masks, wearing gloves, social distancing in public spaces, those kinds of things. Other people have exactly the opposite feelings, that people who engage in those things are submitting themselves to some kind of control, and they're very vocal about not being involved in that. What's your advice to people who are trying to go about their lives in the way that they say, and they come across resistance from their fellow citizens? What's your advice on how to de-escalate some of those tense situations so they don't need to involve police?
That's tough. I mean, obviously, things change quickly and have been changing quickly. You know, what I always tell my kids and a lot of my coworkers is you can control what you can control. So, you know, when it comes to those types of situations, you know, if you feel unsafe, you can remove yourself. Obviously, if you want to call the police, you can. We can respond. But you can employ practices for yourself to keep yourself safe. We, as police officers, are in the business of protecting people's civil rights. And so we look for guidance through our state government, our federal government. We've relied heavily on the district attorney here in La Crosse County, as well as our partners, with the health department and everything else to help guide us through, the changes that come quickly and the rules and where we're at. And so, I totally empathize with, there's a lot of people in the community. I see stuff on social media that people are stressed about what they're being asked to do or what they feel they're being told to do. And understand that as police, we are human beings too, and we experience those emotions and we wonder what's next. And you need to maintain your personal wellness. You need to, and like I said, you focus on what you can control and how you can keep yourself healthy and well. I think those are the biggest things that you can do.
Captain Andrew Dittman with the La Crosse Police Department, thank you very much for spending some time with us today.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. If you'd like to visit our website and see previous episodes of our program, which you can stream on demand, or get in touch with us about something, you can do that at WPR.org/newsmakers. The program continues in just a moment. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. From Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall. We're talking about COVID-19 and its effect on La Crosse's homeless population, and not only La Crosse, but throughout the Coulee region, the homeless population and people at risk of becoming homeless and where they might turn for help and some resources. And I'm joined today by two guests to talk about this issue. Major Jeff Richardson is with the Salvation Army here in La Crosse, and Julie McDermott is with the Coulee Collaborative to End Homelessness. First of all, let me thank each of you for joining us today. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for asking us. Yeah.
So tell me, first of all, maybe, Julie, let me start with you. Just talk about what we know about the number of homeless people in the La Crosse area or throughout the Coulee region.
So we probably have at any given time anywhere from somewhere around 250 individuals and individuals that are part of a family household that are homeless at any given time. And that may be homeless literally on the streets. You might see them in the park. They might be in shelters. They could be potentially couch surfing from household to household.
Major Richardson, when you're helping people at the Salvation Army, how many people, I don't know how you quantify it, on a daily basis or on a weekly basis, how many people are you serving who struggle with homelessness to one degree or another?
Well, it varies by day, of course. But during this COVID crisis that we've been facing, we've been mostly focusing on keeping people safe and warm and well-sheltered. So we've been floating around mid-30s to high 40 for a number. But during the wintertime, it goes up. During the summertime, it goes down. So it just depends on day-to-day demand.
Do you think that's because the number of homeless fluctuates that much during those time, or in the summertime, they're more able to kind of fend for themselves, and in the winter, they're more at risk because of the weather?
Well, yeah, there's, of course, a lot of factors that go into it. Some folks don't do well in a shelter-type environment based on whatever is going on with them at that particular moment. And so they choose to live out in the elements. And we've seen that even during the COVID situation. Certainly during the wintertime, when the weather drops below, to the point that we can freeze in just a matter of moments, they're more than willing to come in. And so it varies by personal choice. Sometimes they just want to get out of the elements and come in, and that's fine. Sometimes they really want to address a problem. And while they're here, they can be separated from the challenges and address those things. It's a wide open kind of a thing to describe.
Julie, homelessness can mean a lot of things depending on as you alluded to, whether we're talking about somebody who literally lives on the street or somebody who simply doesn't have a home of their own, but who might be able to find a place to sleep with a friend or family for a period of time. Is there sort of a definition of homeless that could help us kind of understand what it means to actually, by definition, be homeless?
Sure. There's actually four HUD-defined definitions of homelessness. So HUD is the Housing and Urban Development, the federal government. And so the purposes of our funding, a lot of the HUD funding that we receive in our communities, so Salvation Army gets some for the purposes of sheltering, Coolie Cap gets a large amount of funding from HUD in order to provide permanent supportive housing, a very valuable service in our community. Catholic Charities and the YWCA receive HUD dollars to provide what's called rapid rehousing. So it's a shorter term program. And to be eligible for those programs, those HUD funded programs, you have to meet their category one definition of homeless. And that means that the person has to be literally homeless on the streets or in an emergency shelter, or they could potentially be in a hotel, but it has to be paid for by an emergency service, so by an agency or a church because of an emergency. If somebody's paying for a hotel for a couple of nights, then we do have quite a few homeless community members who receive Social Security benefits. And so when they get their benefits, they'll pay for a room. They don't necessarily have enough money to pay for a hotel room every night of the month, but they'll pay for a hotel room here or there. When they are paying for that, they're not considered homeless. The other definition of homelessness that we that HUD uses literally homeless and makes somebody eligible for programming is if they are fleeing domestic violence. So not just having had the experience of domestic violence, but actively fleeing domestic violence and not having another place to, a place of their own to lay their head down at night. So if they're in shelter or if they're sheltering with a friend or family member and they're actively fleeing, we consider them homeless. But for the purposes of collaborative work, we look at all the different, that the whole spectrum of homelessness, because we think about it in terms of cost to the community. Even when somebody doesn't necessarily meet that HUD definition of homelessness, if they're bouncing around, you know, between their friend's house and a family member's house, and maybe they're spending a couple of nights out on the street when the weather's okay and paying for a hotel another night or two, they're generally people that are relying on a lot of emergency services. They're probably more likely to have contact with the police. They're probably not connecting to medical care providers, and so they're probably using the emergency room as their primary source of care. And so that's a huge cost to the community, and the collaborative looks at people in those situations as homeless for the purposes of its work. We know we have to serve those folks in order to find a sustainable solution to homelessness in our community.
Major Richardson, in terms of the Salvation Army, what kinds of resources are available for someone who might be facing homelessness, and how might they get in touch with you?
Well, certainly there, of course, is the shelter here, and most of the time they will be referred from another agency or just present of their own choice. Then once they get in, we have case managers here that really the goal is to try and get them as quickly as we possibly can into permanent housing. And as you can imagine, there's a lot of moving parts in that. Sometimes there's perhaps a debt that they've got to overcome before a landlord sees them as able to support the thing. So we'll help them work through that. Sometimes there's legal matters. Sometimes they have some addictions that need to be worked through. So we have a variety of programs, and we connect with other agencies throughout the community to sort of partner in and meet the various needs that somebody might have.
Of the people that you're working with, Major Richardson, how often are mental health issues a part of the equation there?
Quite often. Just the fact that they have lived in that environment for a period of time, there certainly is a strong possibility of depression. You and I struggle day to day with our normal pressures. Imagine what it's like without a good support system underneath you. Where am I going to get my meals? Is somebody going to harass me? So there's a lot of that. Sometimes it's some longstanding problem they've carried with them, but quite a few of those mental challenges present pretty regularly.
What other kinds of resources are available in the community? I know, Julie, you mentioned that that your organization, the Cooley Collaborative in Homelessness, works with the Salvation Army and Catholic Charities and others. What other kinds of opportunities for service are there, people who are trying to meet the needs of the homeless?
So, like I mentioned before, there are some HUD-funded supported housing programs. That would include Cooley CAP Housing First programs, which are permanent supportive programs meant to provide, it pairs a financial subsidy along with pretty intensive case management support for somebody for as long as needed. That's for our folks with a lot of barriers being able to maintaining their own housing. And then we have Catholic Charities and the YWCA have what's called rapid rehousing programs. These are programs that are shorter in duration, usually 18 months to 24 months worth of assistance. And again, it's a financial subsidy paired with case management support meant to give that person what they need, the support they need to get their lives put back together. So when the program ends, they're able to sustain housing on their own. And then we have prevention. And I think we've done a really awesome job in La Crosse recognizing that prevention, keeping people from the experience of homelessness in the first place, is really, you know, one of the best strategies that we can take towards ending homelessness. And so we were very thankful for from the La Crosse County Board, $500,000 a couple years ago now, was designated for the collaborative to essentially build a really robust prevention program, which we actually operate through four of the agencies in our community, including Salvation Army, Catholic Charities, Independent Living Resources, and the La Crosse Area Family Collaborative. So clients who may be at risk of losing their housing, and even further upstream than that, you know, they start seeing the signs of trouble. Maybe they've lost a job, they're experiencing illness, they don't have insurance, that kind of thing. They can come to us and we can work with them to provide both case management support as well as a financial assistance.
Major Richardson, how often do you find somebody has worked with one of your case managers, they've come through your system and you've been able to find some resources to help them? And how often do you find that those people are then able to stay the course and remain homed and able to provide more for themselves than they previously did?
Well, actually, we've been pretty successful with the partner agencies that help make funding available and then support individuals who are there once they're in a home. You know, there is, of course, the occasional return back to shelter because something didn't get solved along the way. But I would say we're probably in a 60 to 70% success rate of placing someone in a home and having them stay there. So I think we're doing pretty good in that respect.
Something that I'm really proud of with the collaborative is that we've been doing a really good job over the last 2 years of tracking the data. So tracking the individuals who's coming back into the system, and how do we need to take a look at the programs, how they're designed in our community to serve people, really looking at being able to design programs to serve those folks who have come back in again and again and have this really horrible history of trauma in their lives.
That's Julie McDermott of the Cooley Collaborative to End Homelessness. We're also talking today to Major Jeff Richardson of the Salvation Army in La Crosse, and I'm grateful for their expertise and the perspective that they're offering on our conversation about homelessness today on Newsmakers. If you'd like to get in touch with our program, if you'd like to stream on demand previous episodes, you can do that at wpr.org/newsmakers. Our conversation continues in a moment. We'll talk about how the community can help and how some of the issues are dealt with when the community comes in contact with the homeless and the frustrations that some people express. We'll also talk about the plight of homeless veterans and much more. That's coming up on Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Ezra Wall in our La Crosse studios. Grateful to be joined today by Major Jeff Richardson of the Salvation Army, Julie McDermott of the Cooley Collaboration to End Homelessness. We've been talking about the plight of the homeless, and especially in light of COVID-19. So let's just start right there with the Safer at Home order that was in place for about 2 months and has recently been lifted by the state Supreme Court. And so how did that order affect the plight of the homeless? I mean, it seems, you know, the order is, ironically to this conversation, named Safer at Home. We're talking about people who have no home to go to. Let's start with you, Major Richardson. How did you see the people who you serve affected by the Safer at Home order and by COVID-19 in general?
Well, I'll tell you, we were guided primarily at the beginning by the leadership of the Cooley Collaborative to End Homelessness and the Community Health Department, the County Health Department, both of which were very concerned about the well-being of this population. So in the beginning, we just sort of tried to follow everything to the letter of the law and then realized, well, there could be people who are affected by this flu. How are we going to handle them? There could be people who have the symptoms, but, you know, they're not a full-blown case. Where do they go? They got people that are at risk. Where do they go? So it was a moving target in the beginning. But and I must say that Julie and the collaborative did a great job of sort of stepping up to the plate and sort of mapping out a plan. But we, as other people in the community, were concerned that this population didn't have the opportunity to just sort of get sick and sort of get forgotten while we all go into our homes. I mean, it's easy for us to forget when we have safe places to go. And so we tried to think through that whole thing.
So Julie, how did you and your other partners see the homeless population in the Cooley region being affected by COVID-19, by the stay at home orders, by all of that?
Well, so I think Major Jeff gives me too much credit, but the Salvation Army, staff from Salvation Army and Catholic Charities really stepped up. We realized right away once we started getting news about the pandemic that, you know, here we were in March with two shelters that were pretty much at capacity every single night, turning people away even, and neither shelter, when they're at capacity, having the space to provide appropriate social distancing. So we knew we had to do something quickly. And so that's where we started up a new shelter at the Cathedral School location to be able to move specifically our Warming Center clients there, to be able to give them more space for social distancing, but also to allow for increased capacity to be able to bring in anybody who wanted shelter who wasn't getting it already. And additionally, being able to provide that shelter 24 hours a day. So that's something that neither shelter was offering previously. The Warming Center being a night by night, and Salvation Army, while residents are able to stay there during the day, they're mostly asked to go out and be working on their plans to achieve employment or access to benefits or find new housing. So we had to be prepared to serve people 24 hours a day. And I'm so proud of all of our staff at both shelters, because that was a feat to change a whole program, start up a whole new shelter. It was amazing. We got it done, and we've been working together ever since. And because our community acted so quickly, we were able to keep everybody well. To this date, we've had not a single homeless person in our community has gotten sick with COVID. And because of that, that really changed our perspective on what we were doing in shelters. No longer were we sort of reacting to just make sure that everybody had a roof over their head and a place to be 24 hours a day. We realized, like, we got to focus on making the best out of this situation. Let's get them housed. That's our primary objective. That would have been the answer to all of this in the first place. Had they been housed, we wouldn't have had to figure out a shelter situation. So now our shelter staff are all kicking it up a notch. Actually, we merged the two shelters together now. Over at Salvation Army, we have staff from both Catholic Charities and Salvation Army working at Salvation Army pretty much around the clock to get people housed now. And we've been really successful so far. We had 7 people move into housing, and I believe we have 4 or 5 more that have signed leases and are getting ready to go out to housing of their own soon. And we're just going to keep at it until we get them all housed.
In terms of the community and the level of support that you see from the community, obviously, there's a great desire among people to provide for those who are less fortunate. And still, among the homeless population, and certainly not all of them, maybe not most of them, but there are instances where it can be difficult to try to provide help because of circumstances that arise in some of those situations, the tension that these people sometimes experience in life spilling over into opportunities where volunteers are interacting with them. How can you help the community to understand the plight of these people, and how can you go about your jobs as advocates with the needs and understanding of the community in mind, in terms of what it's like to have some of these issues that come up in your community?
Well, I know for us at the Collaborative, is all about putting a face on homelessness, because I think it is easy to drive past the park and see a lot of people sitting around and maybe drinking or, using drugs or something like that, and make a judgment about people. Almost every one of us folks out there has a story, and a lot of them are really heartbreaking. We've done with the Collaborative, I think we've done a good job. We've started up what's called a Consumer Advisory Council. And this is people who are currently homeless and people who have transitioned out of homelessness have their own council in which they organize themselves to provide input with regard to all of our collaborative activities. And it's nice because a lot of them are able to help us. They're a part of the Collaborative. They're a part of all we do, and they're willing to speak out on behalf of the Collaborative and to talk about themselves. We had a gal named Sarah Bowman who was really brave and shared her story with the La Crosse Tribune. They did a really lovely job with it. And I think it's important to put that face on homelessness, so that people have made mistakes in their lives, but they do deserve love and care and respect and dignity as much as anybody in our community. And when they're given that, they can and they do succeed.
So what about, we hear a lot about, different populations and how they're affected by homelessness, but really a lot of people are concerned with the plight of homeless veterans because there's the notion that I would guess is shared by everybody that of all of the people, I mean, nobody should experience homelessness, but of all the people who might experience homelessness, one would think that people who have gone to such great lengths to sacrifice for our country might be spared from that, or hopefully could be spared from that. What efforts are underway in the La Crosse area, starting with the Salvation Army and then maybe moving to Julie? What efforts are underway to help veterans who find themselves at risk of homelessness?
Well, certainly that is a topic that's close to all of our hearts, and I certainly feel the same way you do. Someone who's given their time and efforts and their life really to protecting our freedoms should be treated differently. But at the same time, they've seen things that we can't even imagine. They've experienced things that we can't even imagine. So there's that human factor in there sometimes really causes problems with that, and they're affected by a lot of the things that they've seen and done, and I can't imagine what it'd be like to have to stand there and defend ourselves to the point of shooting at people. So I mean, there's just a lot of things that have happened there, and I think we do have to be compassionate to that and realize that sometimes they just can't find their way through it. I play guitar, and we did a little Christmas sing one time, Christmas carol sing out in the homeless shelter, and a guy just sat there and cried, and because it reminded him of a better time. And it wasn't long after that he had committed suicide. Now, he was a veteran, and I had the distinct honor of performing his funeral. So that was I think we got to do better for our veterans, for people who have given such a great gift for us.
Julie, what kind of resources are available if a veteran is facing homelessness?
Well, much like there are a variety of categories of definitions of homelessness from HUD, there's a variety of categories of service to be classified as a veteran. And so different individuals, depending upon their level of service, will be qualified for different things. And the collaborative works with a number of different programs, the Center for Veterans Initiative, the TOMA VA, and a program called VORP, Veterans Outreach and Recovery Program, regionally, to be able to provide services to a veteran of any level of service. So there's something out there, no matter what. Somebody may not qualify for the level of service provided by what's called a HUD-VASH program through the TOMA VA, but more than likely we can get them qualified for services through the Center for Veterans Initiatives or the VLIRP program. So all of our case managers across the community from different agencies, including those from Salvation Army, we do case conferencing every 2 weeks. And we do our best to, as soon as we've identified a veteran in our shelters or maybe one of our outreach team from Independent Living Resources identifies a veteran who is unsheltered, we do our best to find out what their level of service was. We get verification of that, and then we get them connected to the appropriate service. And so in 2016, we had achieved functional zero on veteran homelessness in the La Crosse community. We saw a surge in it last summer, but we're back down to now only, I believe we only have 3 veterans currently homeless right now, but we know who they all are. We're getting them connected to services, and the focus with functional zero is to get them back into housing within 30 days of us identifying them. So we definitely prioritize homeless veterans. And I just want to give a shout out to Salvation Army. Their director of social services is a vet, Chris Pikui. So definitely we have a special place in our hearts for veterans.
Well, our conversation is drawing to a close, and I certainly appreciate both of you talking to us about this important issue, on which we could spend so much more time. But I want to give you each an opportunity to tell folks how they can get in touch with your organizations if they need assistance or if they would like to become part of the solution by either donating or volunteering. Let's start with the Salvation Army. Major Richardson, how can people get in touch with the Salvation Army?
Well, sure. We've got our website, and there's an opportunity for people to use a credit card and make a donation there. They could even text to 24365 and make a donation, or they could send it in through the mail in the same way that you do day to day.
And the website that you mentioned is
www.salacrosse.org.
SALacrosse.org. And Julie, how can people reach the Cooley Collaborative to End Homelessness?
All of my contact information is on our website, which is endhomelessnesslacrosse.org. That's all spelled out. So there's a contact page for me. If they have questions about services, I'm happy to direct them. There's also information on the webpage about volunteering and donating in kind. While the collaborative doesn't do much with volunteers, we direct them to places like the Salvation Army and Catholic Charities. And you can donate money, but you can also donate in kind to a program called The Exchange. And there's information about The Exchange, and that would be furniture items. All of our folks need help furnishing an apartment when they get their new home.
Absolutely. Well, I certainly appreciate your time today, Major Jeff Richardson of the Salvation Army, Julie McDermott of the Cooley Collaborative to End Homelessness. Thank you both very much for joining us on Newsmakers.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you for having us.
This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Ezra Wall. Thank you for joining us. Coming up next, a conversation about people raising money to help artists whose income has been affected by COVID-19 and by the stay-at-home orders in Wisconsin and Minnesota. That's coming up. You can learn more about our program on our website, wpr.org/newsmakers. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. Listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Ezra Wall in our La Crosse studios in the Southwest region. Thank you very much for joining us today. We're wrapping up today's show by focusing on the arts. It's as everything has been kind of canceled and rescheduled, a lot of people who make their living, or at least part of their living, through their involvement with the arts have really fallen on hard times. It's hard enough, most people would admit, to make a living as a musician or a painter or as some kind of an artist other than that. But especially now with the public hunkering down and doing a lot of staying home and our societies just now beginning to open up a little bit, it's been particularly hard for a lot of people. And we're joined now by two members of the Midwest Music Fest. We've got Managing Director Abby Lee, and we've got a board member, Jackie Marcoux. Thank you very much, both of you, for joining us.
Thanks for having us, Ezra.
Sure, sure. So I don't know who wants to go first. Maybe we'll start with Abby. Just set up a little bit for people who are not familiar what the Midwest Music Fest is and what you do.
Yeah, so we are a nonprofit organization that is part of our mission is to support arts and artists in the communities that we work in, which is currently Winona and La Crosse. And we do that largely through two music festivals during the year, one in Winona and one in La Crosse, that bring new music and lots of local, lots of nationwide bands together that are kind of up-and-coming artists. And we also work in our local schools, and we also have a mental health initiative as part of our year-round work.
Jackie, talk about some of the adjustments that you've had to make in recent months as Wisconsin's Safer at Home order and Minnesota's own stay-home orders have been in place.
Abby and Parker Forsala, the creative director of Midwest Music Fest, had to essentially change our in-person music fest to a virtual fest, which we just had about 2 weeks ago, and it was a great success. Definitely still felt the magic at home, but, you know, it's not the same as going to a live show and being there with your people and watching live music. But Abby and Parker did a great job, and we really had some great support from the community, and we're still able to pay our artists and support them. So that was a really great success. So moving forward, in the next couple of months, we're going to be looking at what's possible, what's not possible, and looking at the future of the organization and how we can stay afloat and how we can still support musicians and artists in the community.
So, Abby, as you're kind of dealing with the artists, Jackie just mentioned that the artists that were to have been part of the in-person festival recently but switched to online were still able to be compensated. But that's not the case for all of the artists in our area. What are you hearing from the artists that you're in contact with about their livelihoods?
Yeah, I mean, we're basically just hearing that they were shut down very abruptly. That they're, you know, a lot of them, you know, get up to 100% of their income from in-person, you know, gigs and sales of their merch, and a fair amount of them have second careers in the service industry, which is also taken a huge hit, as you know. So, you know, we were just pretty consistently hearing like we don't have income anymore. So a lot of them, you know, pretty much right off the bat, we were seeing people, musicians start to do online shows like on Facebook and, you know, put their Venmos up. And just the feedback we heard from audiences that, you know, that's what they were doing to lift their spirits, is joining these viewing parties and listening to these musicians play. And the musicians were getting something, you know, they were getting this a bit of the feedback, you know, in terms of those live stream shows that, you know, people could still request things and comment. And so that was one way pretty quickly we saw both artists and audiences be uplifted through music and the arts.
I think a lot of people might not know. I mean, you see, if you see a painting at an art show that is anywhere from hundreds of dollars to even, you know, thousands of dollars, you see a musician whose booking fee is again on the low end, you know, in the hundreds of dollars, to depending on the notoriety of the person or the size of the group that they're working with, you know, maybe thousands of dollars there too. But even for people whose names you would readily recognize, most of these people are not rich. They really do depend on gigging every week or every weekend in order to make a living. So this hits them pretty hard. Tell me about the new effort that Midwest Music Fest is engaged in to try to help some of these artists make ends meet.
Yeah, so we started a fund in collaboration and partnership with Ambient Inks out of Eau Claire, Wisconsin. They are doing something similar, and we borrowed much of their initiative, and they've just been lovely to work with. It's essentially a GoFundMe called the Greater La Crosse Artist Relief Fund, and it serves artists in La Crosse County, Vernon County, and Winona, Minnesota County. And it's essentially a micro grant program that artists can apply, and we have a selection review committee of local folks who or just have been amazing to work with. They'll review the applications and see where the need is. And depending on how many funds we receive in the next 30 days, we'll be able to award up to $500 grants to these artists. It's a pretty seamless, simple application. We're awarding money on need, not on, you know, whether we like the musician or the artist. And it was something that we, Abby and I, you know, given the work that we do with Midwest Music Fest, and our love, our own personal love for the arts, that's a natural place for us to go. Like, how can we further help the artists in this community? And we started looking around the community and started having conversations and really realized that everybody was kind of drowning. And there were relief funds set up for this group or this group. You know, everybody needs it. And we realized there wasn't anything specifically for artists. So with some assistance of local artist Landon Sheely, who essentially just sent us the link for the Chippewa Valley Artist Relief Fund, we looked at that and just said, we have to do this. Like, we don't know how we're going to do it, but we're just going to do it. And so far, we've had some great support from local organizations, La Crosse Arts Board. So we're just going to see what we get and how, and we just really want to help as many people as we possibly can.
So it's the Greater La Crosse Artist Relief Fund, and it's to benefit artists not only in the La Crosse area, but also in the Winona area. And so people just go to GoFundMe.com and find it, or how does that work?
Yeah, the easiest way to find it is probably to head to MidwestMusicFest.org, and you can click right on that Greater La Crosse, or it's, I think it's called Artist Relief Fund, right at the top of the page there. So if you just click on MidwestMusicFest.org and Artist Relief Fund, it takes you to the GoFundMe page, and then from the GoFundMe, there is a link to the artist application as well. You can also find us on Facebook, and there's lots of links there on our page there. And something else I just wanted to mention about the fund is that we, as I mentioned earlier, have a mental health initiative as part of the fest, because we know that artists, just like the rest of us, often struggle with mental health issues. And we wanted to be a part of supporting that. And so right on the application, there are some resources because, you know, when we have money problems, then, you know, those issues that we have are increased a lot of times. So we have found that that a lot of the applicants are wanting to have a mental health professional reach out to them and are interested in talking to somebody. So there is a question on the application about whether they'd like to talk to somebody. And then there's resources also listed right on there.
So whether someone is in need of financial support or emotional support, there are resources available for them.
Exactly.
Perfect. The Midwest Music Fest is behind the Greater La Crosse Artist Relief Fund. You can find more information about it at MidwestMusicFest.org. I've been speaking today with Jackie Marcoux, a board member of Midwest Music Fest, along with Abby Lee, the managing director. Thank you very much for joining us today on Newsmakers.
Thanks, Ezra.
Thank you so much, Ezra.
Absolutely. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. If you'd like to stream on demand any of our previous programs, you can find them on our website, wpr.org/newsmakers. If you'd like to subscribe, you can open your favorite podcast platform and search for Newsmakers and hit the subscribe button. We would appreciate that very much. For John Davis, my producer, thank you very much for joining us. And please catch us again next time on Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio.